1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today in the studio, it's been four decades since the Young Brothers, George, Malcolm, and Angus, paved the long, hard rock road of history down the highway to hell.
We were too set on our ways that, we don't care if we're not big. We just want to keep doing the music we want, you know. It's the perfect thing for us guys. When I look back at it, it's our biggest asset was our stubbornness.
Hi, this is Angus Young of AC/DC.
This is Malcolm Young from AC/DC in the studio.
For Let There Be Rock, for Highway to Hell.
Highway to Hell is the final album AC/DC recorded with Bon Scott, the lead singer who provided the group with a fair share of its signature sleaze, writes Stephen Thomas Erlewine on AllMusic.com. This is a veritable rogues gallery of deviants, from cheerfully clumsy sex talk and drinking anthems to general outlandish behavior. And it wasn't just Scott who reached a new peak on Highway to Hell. So did the Young Brothers, crafting their monster riffs into full-fledged, undeniable songs. AC/DC has never sounded so enormous, they've never had such great songs, and they had never delivered an album as singularly bone-crunching until now. End quote. You know, it's easy to forget that by the time AC/DC's August 1979 Highway to Hell album blew up the charts, that the scrappy quintet had already released five previous albums. Born in Scotland, emigrated to Australia, AC/DC's nucleus was rhythm guitar player Malcolm Young, little brother Angus, and their oldest brother as producer George. Although popular in Australia, AC/DC knew as early as 1976 that the path to international success ran through London in those days. After playing clubs around the UK, AC/DC returned to Sydney to record their second international release called Let There Be Rock. Sitting in London, AC/DC co-founder Malcolm Young recalls the effect of that first tour abroad.
That was the most excited I think we had gotten the chance, because everyone in the band wanted to get out of Australia. They knew that you could only go so far there. If you want to be successful, you've got to get to the big guys. You know, we were going to go to the States first, but people at the time in the business said, if you can crack the England, the vibe carries through to the States and makes things a little easier for you. So when we came to England, we had rested all our hopes on it and hoping they would jump on us straight away. But the kids jumped on the band straight away, but no one else did. You know, I mean, media or the music industry, they didn't really know what we were. We were actually very disappointed when we came here, but not the shows were great. We always felt Everyone of those kids had come up way there, and they were going, this is what music's all about. But yet a DJ would never play your track, or if you got a review in the music press, they caught Chunder from Down Under, or, you know, just anything but take the music for what it was. So it was a long sort of hard struggle in the UK, but yet every time we came, the audiences got bigger and bigger, and the band become phenomenally huge here. We had number one albums, everything in the UK, but we still never got any airplay.
A big part of AC/DC's hard-driving appeal came from their tattooed, ear-studded singer Bon Scott. A decade before Guns N' Roses would make tattoos a fashion statement, Bon Scott looked more like a character out of the novel Moby Dick than a rock star. Here's Angus Young of AC/DC in the studio.
Bon had been, I think, one of his early jobs he'd done was being a cray fisherman on boats, and he'd gone out and done that, and this is where he got the tattoos, you know. And I think he was about 15 or 16, I think, from what he said. And, I mean, he was also, in fact, he even, one of the early shows, he was even running around in a kilt. Yeah. So, I mean, he was doing a lot of, and he was the first, and funny enough, even carrying through to today's time, you see a lot of people with the pins and the, you know, the earrings and the piercings. Yeah, he was doing that then. I remember he had his nipples pierced. He was thinking of getting a whalebone through his nose at one point, you know. As soon as they just saw Bond, you know, especially this guy who in his time, you know, was up there with all his tattoos showing and his, you know, he had this big whale thing hanging out his ear, a big whale bone thing. And, you know, he walked on and then he just threw off his shirt and he had bare feet because he used to always, he never wore shoes a lot of times, you know. Yeah, he had just, as, and I think that comes from his fisherman days, yeah? And he just strutted on. It was like they loved him, you know?
A song that would some years later become an AC/DC classic and concert favorite started out titled Dirty Eyes, but after a close encounter with an Amazon-sized woman named Rosie on the island of Tasmania, Bon Scott had to rewrite the lyrics. Here's the late Bon Scott himself.
I was staying in a hotel, you know, well, we all were in the same hotel, and this chick, Rosie, lived across the road, like, and she used to sort of look out and check out which band was in town and go, yeah, hey, over here, boys, like, and we'd go over and have a party, and then she was so big, she'd sort of, you know, close the door and put it on you, for your body, and she was too big to say no to, you know, so I just sort of had to succumb, I had to do it. Oh my God, I wish I hadn't, you know?
But it did inspire a good song.
Well, that's what I'm glad it did, yeah.
Really, it was one of the favorites around.
And she came to one of our shows one time, and she's from Tasmania, actually, and she was in the front row, and she's about 6'2" tall, and like 19 stone, 12 pound. Like, that was some mountain, you know?
Yeah.
You can imagine the problems I had.
Malcolm Young of AC/DC remembers the musical direction they wanted for the album, Let There Be Rock, and why.
We certainly wanted to get heavier in a respect. You know, we thought, well, we've got to really be a little bit more of a rock unit, you know. We'd see a lot of bands coming in from the States. We thought, these guys really drag it out, don't they? They really milk it. they really knew how to get the crowds happening, you know? And we felt we'd got to maybe look at some material in that vein rather than the 3-, 4-, 5-minute songs. Maybe we should look at a little bit, expanding a little, giving Angus a bit more solo room and, you know, just stuff off the wall. So we decided to, you know, hey, anything's possible with this album. Let's see what we can come up with. Don't feel free to suggest what you like, how you feel, but let's just look at everything here and stick to the rock and roll, stick to what we really love, and let's not disappear up our own butts, but let's have a look at seeing what we can really pull off a good album here. And it really toughened the music up. But again, that's, again, going directly against radio and everything like that, ignoring your record company, going totally against the business world of music and just sticking to your guns. We thought, there's no hit single on there for anyone. This is a rock album, you know. So it made us more determined to, you know, to put out a good record like that and to get credibility as a band. And we certainly thought that Let There Be Rock really opened that up. It changed a lot of music, I think, Let There Be Rock, in general terms. Even in today's music, you can hear a lot of things that's come from it, you know?
When we return in the studio, Angus and Malcolm Young tell of their struggle to get exposure in the U.S. and how their difficult journey ended up on a highway to hell. For this and your other favorite rock star interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Angus Young of AC/DC on the 40th anniversary of Highway to Hell.
Hi, this is Angus Young of AC/DC in the studio for Highway to Hell.
It's the anniversary of AC/DC's breakthrough 1979 album Highway to Hell, ranked number 197 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time. I'm Redbeard, After the album Let There Be Rock came the studio album Power Age and then a live album. But AC/DC's record company felt that they were running out of patience with the band and older brother producer George Young. They felt they were running out of chances to get a hit. Here's Angus Young of AC/DC in the studio.
We had been in Australia, and at the time, the record company had said, we used to call them earpieces, yeah? Guys that they would sort of say, well, what do you think? You know, and they would tell the executive people what sounded good and what didn't. They sent over one of them, which was kind of strange, to Australia and we would been in the studio with my brother George, and they had said, this guy had said to my brother George, which I thought at the time was a bit insulting, really, because he said to George, you haven't got a commercial ear. Yeah, he, bold as brass, this guy said it, you know. And you know what really got me going was, I didn't say anything at the time, but when I, afterwards, I had said to the actual boss of the, when we met one of the vice presidents of the company, I said, you know, that was the worst mistake you ever made, I said, because it's bad enough to insult someone who's got the track record that what my brother George had had. I said, he's had hits all over the world from lots of people. And I said, but what was an insult to injury was my brother had the number one record on the pop chart at the time with an act, and it was on their label. It was a subsidiary of their label, you know. So I said, well, so much about your earpiece, you know.
On the eve of that summer 79 release, rhythm guitarist Malcolm Young had amazing rock and roll resolve in the midst of their struggle.
Sure, you feel rejected by the mass media, the mass people, or whatever you want to call it, but it's like we've always thought, there's other people. There's the people we play to. They're not your masses, but they're getting bigger. We always had bigger audiences that kept us going. We had kids who got the new record, even in the States, no success. But kids coming up in places like Columbus and then Cleveland and gone, knew every track from every album. The first time we even came to play in the States, we played in Austin. When we went down for a sound check in the afternoon, there was a bunch of guys in there just sweeping up the building. They were all singing TNT.
Really?
Yeah, and we thought, how do those guys know this song, you know? And they're going, oh, fuck. And everyone's got it, all the guys are picking up on this stuff. You know, there was a radio station out of San Antonio had picked up on the band, and it started word of mouth, you know? But the way we're growing, we can just be a live band. We don't have to make records. We were starting to feel we can just play and play for the rest of our lives, this music. Who needs records? Who needs them? You know, who needs big stage productions? We were just a tight unit that would, you know, we never thought we were going to be a huge band either. This is something I must say. We just felt like it beats a 9-to-5 job. We can get laid every now and then and travel the world. That was the bottom line. So everything else was a bonus, you know. And if it all ended and we got 3 or 4 years from it by that point already, we thought, well, we've done great, better than we had ever expected. We've got to the States. We've got to play to good crowds of people. We've done some big open air gigs as a first act on, things like that. We felt chuffed, and the kids seemed to really like us. But the label weren't having success with the record, and I guess the management dealt with all that crap. But we sort of, we were too set on our ways that, we don't care if we're not big. We just want to keep doing the music we want, you know. It's the perfect thing for us, guys. When I look back at it, it's our biggest asset was our stubbornness to stick to our guns, you know?
Hi, this is Angus Young of AC/DC in the studio for Highway to Hell.
I'm Redbeard in the studio with Angus Young of AC/DC on the 40th anniversary of Highway to Hell. To begin work on what would become the Highway to Hell album, AC/DC's record company replaced brother George Young with the veteran rock engineer producer Eddie Kramer. But the band didn't click with Eddie. So the brothers, Angus and Malcolm, plotted to send a message in a bottle, so to speak, to a young producer named Robert John Mutt Lang. But they were literally broke. Here's Angus Young of AC/DC.
And we didn't have any. I mean, we arrived in America at that time. I think we'd $10 between us. You know? And Mutt Lang had talked to Malcolm, you know, and he said, look, I've heard what you guys have got. You know, what Malcolm sent him a tape. We actually had written most of the songs in a weekend, believe it or not, for Highway to Hell. A lot of those tracks were done on a weekend because we had to go. Because when we were working a lot, Eddie Cray, the guy we were working with, it was all he. Besides not letting us do what we wanted to do, he kept steering us everywhere else, you know, and it became hard to work. So we had to tell him, look, we're going to have the weekend off. We're going to have a few days, you know. And he said, oh, great, that'll be good. I can do something. Yeah, so he had the weekend off. And while he had the weekend off, we snuck in the rehearsal studio. And we had a few ideas, but most of we put it all together on that weekend and put a tape together and sent it to Mutt Lang. And he said, look, I hear what you're trying to do. I'm sure I can do you a great job.
Rhythm guitar player Malcolm Young of AC/DC.
We had Highway to Hell, Girls Got Rhythm, Shot Down in Flames, If You Want Blood, You Got It. We had all these tracks written. We realised we could make things a little bit more straight ahead but clever and still rock. You know, this was what it was all about. It just, we were getting a little bit more mature in the head then. That album was destined anyway. It was coming out no matter who produced it, as far as we was concerned. It would have been sold at gigs by the band if we had no label, you know. We were still sticking to our guns. And then, in fact, at the end of that record, Highway to Hell, everyone was so excited about it, and they thought the hit single was the track Highway to Hell. They wanted to change the title because they didn't think it would sit well in the States because of the Bible Belt regions and what have you. So they wanted to change it to like a telephone number, the title of Highway to Hell.
To a telephone number?
To a telephone number. We just got up and walked out of the studio. We couldn't believe it. We said, this is it. Screw them. That's it. They came back the next day. Oh, it's okay. It can stay. It can stay. I guess there may be a lot of pressure put on people to get this band established, if you know what I mean. It was just like, you know, it's your typical video where you got a rock band and you got the big manager with who knows everything except music. You know, making wheels and deals on the side. It was that sort of vibe. You felt that I don't like this business. I like music. You know what I mean? we got music in us for forever. You know, and it'll rock forever too. It'll never slow down. You know.
Upon the release of AC/DC's 1979 Highway to Hell album, the rockin' fury and determination of this quintet could no longer be denied anywhere. One of the distinctive aspects of AC/DC was the sound of lead singer Bon Scott's voice, which had the bullhorn sheer volume of Slade's Naughty Holder combined with the soulful wail of the Small Faces and Humble Pie singer, the late Steve Marriott. Here's Malcolm Young of AC/DC.
Stevie Marriott was a brilliant singer. Yeah, I think one of Bond's favourites, not as a person, Stevie Marriott could have been quite, he was quite rude, you know, put it politely.
Yeah, I heard, yeah.
But he had a great voice, a great rock and roll voice, great feel, you know. He was a big idol of Bond's until Bond actually met him, but he still loved his voice, you know.
After all of the struggle, all of the years of bucking the odds, AC/DC was heralded as the real deal. Highway to Hell sold millions, and AC/DC became headliners to huge crowds. But Bon Scott would enjoy the heat and the light of the bonfire AC/DC had ignited for only 8 short months. First, Angus Young.
I got a call from a girlfriend of his, and she had said she had been in a bit of panic. She had heard Bon had died, yeah, but she was uncalm. She said, "I'm trying to get." She didn't seem to really know what had happened, but I just heard the words that he had died, and I had said, are you sure? And she said, I don't know for sure, but I'm trying to get a hold of the guy who was managing us at the time. So I said, look, I'll get back to you. Yeah. And then the phone went again, and there was another girl that he knew, and she had been expecting him. She had been waiting, and she was worried. She was worried about, she didn't know where he was. And then I got a hold of our manager, and he said, well, he'd been already onto it, trying to find out some information. He says, because no one had been informed, because they had tried to get through to the coroner and medical guy, because we, at that point, even the manager didn't know. He said, look, it might be some crazy rumor, I don't know, you know. He just said, this is what he had heard, and he was trying to find out. He said, when I got through to these people, they said they had to contact the next of, his family before they can give out any information about who it was. But he finally found out, the manager finally, he tracked down, I think, either the guy who had been with him, and he found out through him. So he got back, and that's when I found out that it was Bond.
By February 19 of 1980, lead singer Bon Scott was dead after a drinking binge with a friend. In the case of AC/DC's Highway to Hell, marking its 40th anniversary this summer, it seems that even some of the best music writers still struggle to evaluate the album on its merits alone, instead are sucked into the absurd notion that lead singer-lyricist Bon Scott's accidental death in February 1980 somehow could have influenced Highway to Hell's songs that were written and recorded a year prior. Some hacks won't let the facts get in the way of a sensational story. Before he too passed away in November 2017, AC/DC's Malcolm Young set the record straight with me here in the studio in no uncertain terms about the circumstances on the night of Bon Scott's death.
Bon always knew what he was doing. You know, I never saw Bon drunk on stage, ever in my life. I was the sort of unspoken leader of the band in a way. You know, if I looked at Bon, said, Bon, are you okay? I'm all right. You know, I would have checked him sometime. But if I felt like that, I would have certainly pulled Bon over and say, listen, you got a gig to do. I never had to once do that to Bon, never. He had his own rules, Bon, you know, but he was always in control of them. Afterwards, Bon maybe went, that's when Bon, if he had a great night, a couple of nice chicks hanging off him, hey, that man was the happiest man in the world. I'm sure he didn't want to get drunk and collapse with two beautiful chicks hanging off him, you know. He would make it last, you know. He knew what life was. Bon never was on a death wish, you know. Bon was unlucky because he just happened to fall asleep with his head in the wrong position, you know, from a big night of drink. We've all done these big nights of drinking, you know. Everyone's had that one or two, three too many some nights. You know, when you have one too many, it can be a dozen too many, because after that one, who knows? You're not really responsible. But that his only crime was he had his head back on his car seat, which it stopped him from throwing up, you know. So I just look like he was really unlucky. That was the problem. You know, nothing deeper, nothing more. You know, I just wished it never happened to him, because there was a lot of people who really missed him, you know, because not the people who just love his music, but the people that just love Bon, you know. He was a unique person. That's why we can sit around all these years later and still talk about him, you know, because he went before his prime, you know. And it's taken a long time for his due respect, you know, and I just hope it all comes in a correct way now for him, you know. I hope he gets put up there, because, you know, me and Angus were talking, there's guys like Jim Morrison who, you know, become legends and household names. Bond's a legend. He's household name in the rock world, but not right across the boards, but he should be, because it's like Angus said, Bon wasn't a rock star like your Jim Morrison's and people like this. He said, Bon was a rock and roller, you know. He lived that lifestyle. He didn't act that lifestyle. He was what he was, you know? And it's so rare to have something that's real be real, for real. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you make a movie upon, it's got to be real. It's because it's the truth of the guy had a legendary lifestyle. There's no doubt about it. You don't have to make him sound bigger than he ever was because it's all true. In fact, we probably understate Bond because we don't want to embarrass his folks because they always used to think he's a really nice guy. You know?
God bless Bon Scott, George, and Malcolm Young. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Angus Young, and God bless the souls of Malcolm Young and Big Brother George. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.